Was brought up during that committee. We're not getting that as much here in this trial because the governor, of course, is not here. And I think any time that you have the senators, all of them sitting there going through hours of testimony, and as you mentioned, it can be rather cumbersome at times, it probably does not help the governor's case when it comes to a final vote to not have participated as well in this entire process.
On Monday, Sean, there was a crush of national media in the State House there. As the first day of the impeachment trial got underway, have those numbers diminished any, or are they still pretty well represented around the State House?
Well, certainly, not as much as it was on Monday, but there are still a lot of people here because I think they realize this process may not take a whole lot longer. And once they are in, they're here for the certainly here for the verdict in this trial.
Again, on behalf of the House Prosecutor, we'd like to call Vicki Thomas.
Vicki Thomas is the head of the Joint Commission on Administrative Rules. She testified before that House panel, and she is going to be discussing ways in which she believes that the governor went around the legislature and the will of the legislature in creating programs and spending some tax money during his administration. So we'll hear more of that discussion as we're on to our second witness of the day here in the third day of the Senate impeachment trial.
And I recall, too, Sean, that she was pretty articulate in laying out her case before the House Impeachment Committee.
And it certainly has been, this is one of those areas of state government not everybody follows. It doesn't grab a hot lot of headlines, but it's certainly been an area that those who work within state government, those state lawmakers especially, have been very concerned about with the Blagojevich administration. It's led to lawsuits, and especially when it came to expanding a health care program without the legislature's okay. And that is most of what she will be talking about.
Ms. Thomas, Secretary, please swear in the witness in accordance with Impeachment Rule 22.
Please raise your right hand and repeat after me and insert your name at the proper place. I,
Vicki Thomas,
do solemnly swear or affirm,
do solemnly swear,
that the testimony I'm about to give in this manner,
that the testimony I'm about to give in this matter
is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
Is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
The House Prosecutor may commence his direct examination.
Thank you, Your Honor. Would you please state your name and spell your name for the court reporter?
My name is Vicki Thomas, V-I-C-K-I-T-H-O-M-A-S.
Ms. Thomas, could you tell us your job title?
I'm the Executive Director of the Joint Committee on Administrative Rules, usually known as JCAR.
And how did you come to have that position?
I'm appointed by the Senate President, the Speaker of the House, and the two minority leaders.
And how long have you held that position?
For 18 years.
And you identified JCAR as a committee. Could you tell us who sits on the committee?
JCAR is made up of 12 legislators, three each appointed by the president, the speaker, and the two minority leaders.
And when was JCAR created?
In 1977.
And how was JCAR created?
There was an amendment to the Illinois Administrative Procedure Act, which is usually referred to as the IAPA, which is the governing law for the rulemaking process in Illinois. That amendment created JCAR 2 years after the original legislation was passed.
And what is JCAR's primary function?
We're the part of the General Assembly that continues to look at the implementation of statute after it's created. Its implementation is through administrative law. So we review and we act upon agencies' attempts to make administrative law or rules and regulations.
And do you think that's an important function?
Yes, I do. When the General Assembly creates new statute or amends statute, creates programs, it creates a broad outline. It doesn't create day-to-day detail like whether application forms have to be filed, what deadlines are. These are the items that are added later by administrative agencies through delegated authority from the General Assembly, but they can make a big difference. So because it's still part of the implementation of the statute, it's my strong belief that the General Assembly needs to continue to oversee that process.
Okay, and you mentioned rules. Could you tell us what types of rules agencies issue?
There's a number. The three major categories of rules are proposed or permanent rules. That's most of the rules that go through. There's also special categories, emergency rulemaking and peremptory rulemaking.
Okay, I'd like to take those one at a time. Could you explain to us what a proposed permanent rule is?
Okay, like I said, that's most of the rulemakings. It's a situation of where an agency gives notice of its proposal to the public, takes public comment, submits it to JCAR. After JCAR takes action on it, then it adopts the rules.
Does the proposed permanent rule become effective before JCAR takes action?
No. JCAR takes action, and then the agency can adopt the rule.
I think the second category you mentioned was an emergency rule. Could you explain what an emergency rule is?
In situations in which there is a threat to the public interest, safety, or welfare, an agency can adopt an emergency rule. It can be effective immediately upon adoption, and at this point, neither the public has been exposed to it, nor has JCAR reviewed it. It's a unilateral action by the agency. An emergency rule is only effective for a maximum of 150 days.
Okay, and the third category you mentioned was called a peremptory rule. Could you explain what that is?
There's three instances in which peremptory rulemaking is if the state is federal law or regulation that requires the adoption of a rule. The second is if there's a collective bargaining agreement that requires a change in the rule. And the third is a court order that requires a change in the rule. It is a permanent rulemaking that's effective immediately when the agency adopts it. JCAR reviews it afterwards.
And does JCAR review every rule?
Yes, we do.
And when does JCAR review rules?
The members meet generally monthly, and then they make they take their actions on rulemakings at that time.
And what does JCAR look for when it's reviewing rules?
We have standards under the law that we have to follow. The basic standard is, does the rulemaking have statutory authority, clear statutory authority? Other standards include such things as legislative intent, effect on the state budget, economic impact on the affected public, whether the agency has created adequate standards to control its own actions. We have a variety of standards for review, but those are the major ones.
You indicated that JCAR reviews rules. Does it take action regarding those rules as well?
Yes, we do.
And what types of actions does it take, say, to approve a rule?
The simplest action we can take is to issue a certificate of no objection. We do that when the committee finds nothing important wrong with what the agency's doing. The strongest action that JCAR can take is to suspend or prohibit filing of a rule.
Okay, a certificate of no objection, does that have the effect of allowing a proposed permanent rule to go into effect or allowing an emergency or peremptory rule to continue in effect?
Certificates of no objection only occur on the proposed rules. So with this certificate, the agency can go to the Secretary of State's office and adopt its rule.
And you indicated something about suspending a rule. Could you explain what it means to suspend a rule?
Suspension and filing prohibition are basically the same action. When the underlying rulemaking was an emergency rule or a peremptory rule that's already gone into effect, then JCAR suspends that rule and it can no longer have any effect.
What does it mean to prohibit a rule?
With respect to a proposed rule that's not yet gone into effect, JCAR prohibits, which means the agency is stopped from ever adopting it in the first place.
And how does JCAR prohibit or suspend a rule?
This has to be done by a 3/4 vote of the membership when we have a full 12-member panel seated. That's 8 votes.
And how does JCAR do it? Does it issue a written prohibition or suspension?
Yes, a motion is offered and passed at a JCAR meeting. That then is reduced to a statement of objection and filing prohibition or objection and suspension. And then that's published in the Illinois Register and filed with the Secretary of State.
And as a general rule, why does JCAR suspend or prohibit a rule?
This is an action that JCAR reserves for the most serious violations of those rulemaking standards that I referred to, statutory authority, legislative intent, etc.
And how often does JCAR suspend or prohibit a rule?
It's a rare action. In 31-year history of JCAR, they've considered probably 20,000 rulemakings. In that time, they've issued 69 prohibitions or suspensions. Half of those, almost half, 33 of those have occurred under the current administration.
All right, Ms. Thomas, I believe you've been tendered a copy of Exhibit Number 51, which, ladies and gentlemen, is part of the record and is in the packets that's been distributed for the JCAR witnesses. Do you recognize this document, Ms. Thomas?
Yes, I do.
And what is it?
This is a notice of emergency rulemaking filed by the Department of Health Care and Family Services in early November of 2007.
You say it was a notice of emergency rules?
Yes.
Is that correct? Okay. Could you briefly describe the rule?
The rulemaking did two things. It, first of all, did what was called an S-CHIP pickup, and then the second half of it expanded the family care program.
Would you explain the first half, what you described as the S-CHIP pickup, please?
S-CHIP is it's a federal program called the State Children's Health Insurance Program. In Illinois, that basic S-CHIP program is called KidCare. Okay, there's also another component to KidCare that's called Family Care. And Family Care is a program run under a waiver that the state of Illinois received from the federal government that allowed certain adults to be covered as well. These adults were the parents of children who were in kid care. So we got a 5-year waiver that let us run a program called Family Care. That waiver expired September 30th of 2007. At that point, the approximately 20,000 adults who'd been covered by kid care were at a position where the federal government support for their coverage was going to go away. So the Department of Health Care and Family Services decided that the state would assume liability for continued health care coverage for those people, and they embodied that in this emergency rule.
And you mentioned that there were two parts. You mentioned that there were two parts to that rule. Could you explain what the second part of that rule was?
In addition to picking up the people being left behind by the S-CHIP waiver, HFS proposed to expand the family care program itself. Again, that's the adult coverage program. To that point, it had had a 185% of federal poverty level income cap. In this rulemaking, the department decided to increase that to 400% FPL.
By PL, do you mean poverty level?
Federal poverty level, yes.
Okay. And what was JCAR's response to the emergency rule?
JCAR voted an objection and suspension, and then it also voted a recommendation.
And could you explain the recommendation?
The recommendation was that the department agree to separate those two issues, to separate the S-CHIP pickup from the family care expansion.
And could you explain the objection and suspension?
The objection and suspension were based on the fact that while the department adequately showed that there was an emergency situation with respect to the S-CHIP pickup, it had not made the members comfortable with the fact that there was an emergency requiring the family care expansion.
And so what was the effect of the suspension and objection?
As of the time that that suspension was filed with the Secretary of State, the rules for the family care expansion could no longer be invoked or administered by the department.
And then what happened next?
The next step came in February of 2008 when the permanent version of this emergency rule came before JCAR.
And what did JCAR do with the proposed permanent rule?
This time JCAR issued an objection and filing prohibition.
And why did JCAR do so?
The reasons cited in the motion were that, first of all, the department could not show that it had specific statutory authority to expand family care. Secondly, it showed that there was no special FY08 budget line item that was to cover a family care expansion, meaning that the General Assembly could not see that there would not be a bad economic impact on the state from the expansion. And then the third item was legislative intent. A very similar or a practically identical issue had been considered by the General Assembly the previous spring and had not been successfully enacted.
Did the department abide by JCAR's decision?
No, it did not.
And do you believe that by not abiding by JCAR's decision, did the department violate state law?
Yes, I do.
I have no further questions for this witness. Thank you, Your Honor.
Pursuant to Senate Resolution 7, the governor or his counsel has the right to conduct a cross-examination of this witness. However, as neither the governor nor counsel has, on his behalf, have appeared, there can be no cross-examination. Therefore, we'll proceed directly to taking written questions from the senators regarding the testimony of this witness. The chair recognizes President Cullerton. For what purpose do you rise, sir?
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. I'd like to ask for a Democratic caucus for the purpose of formulating questions to ask this witness, also perhaps to take a lunch break and come back when you decide we should.
Senator Redonio, for what purpose do you rise?
Thank you, Chief Justice. So we would also request a caucus for the purpose of formulating questions.
There will be allowance for a half-hour caucus, and the court will see the Senate will stand recessed until 1 p.m. And we have the lunch break at the same time as the caucus. The House will stand, the Senate will stand adjourned.
From Illinois Public Radio in Springfield, this is live coverage of the impeachment trial of Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich in the state Senate. I'm Jenna Dooley, joined by State House Bureau Chief Sean Crawford. The senators just finished listening to testimony from Vicki Thomas, who is involved with the state's rulemaking authority. Senators have taken a break to formulate questions for Ms. Thomas, as well as grab some lunch. Sean, today there are actually signs that there's a disagreement with the way the trial is progressing. There's almost the sense that Republicans think things are moving too fast, while Democrats kind of want to trim down the witness list, maybe to move things along. Is that your sense?
Well, that seems to be what we were getting at least earlier. Now, that is before the Chief Justice Tom Fitzgerald brought in both the Republican leader Christine Redonio and the Senate President John Cullerton into a private meeting in his chambers to talk to them. We don't know exactly what was discussed there, but it could very well have been some type of decision to get everybody more on the same page, at least of where the process is going as far as how the schedule will work and all of that. So we don't know for sure, but there did seem to be some disagreement early on. And then it was interesting for the first time, I believe, that we saw Justice Fitzgerald ask for that private meeting. But you're right, they have now moved to a lunch break and also a private caucus for each party to formulate questions. And Vicki Thomas of the Joint Commission on Administrative Rules, she is the second witness today as they finished up testimony from earlier with State Representative Chapin Rose. We believe also we'll hear from the state's Auditor General today, William Holland, and he will discuss several critical audits of the Blagojevich administration. We may also hear from another state representative today, but the witness list slowly working its way through this witness list at this point. And we may be winding down by the end of the day as far as the case that the special prosecutor is putting on.
And you expect that it'll be the same process? There's a person testifies, then a caucus to formulate questions, kind of back and forth like that?
I expect that, yes. I think we will probably get that later on today as well. Right now, like I said, this is something that that has happened among on each witness so far, and it's the way that that this process will likely play out. There has been discussion among some of the people we've talked to that that we could see a vote in the Illinois Senate, maybe as soon as tomorrow. Definitely, we think certainly by Friday one is likely, and that would be a vote, of course, to whether or not to remove the governor from office. The governor having already been impeached by the Illinois House, but it's the state Senate who decides on whether or not he gets to keep his job. The governor, for the third straight day, not surprisingly, we were aware of this, but he is not present, nor does he have any legal representation in the chamber today.
And Sean, if you could briefly recap what we heard from Vicki Thomas. It's very bureaucratic in that JCAR, can you kind of go through that and why she is being brought to testify?
Sure. She is being brought in because the Joint Commission on Administrative Rules, which is really a panel that once legislation is passed or programs are in place, oftentimes special rules need to be adopted to make them work, and this panel oversees that. The governor tried to go around the legislature on a health care expansion and ask for rules to be put together and allow this expansion to take place. The panel decided no, that was not going to happen. This is a panel made up of lawmakers, and the governor went ahead and expanded health care anyway, began signing up people for this special program. In the end, it's led to a lawsuit, and that still is playing its way out in the courts. But it was interesting, one of the more interesting points, I think, that she made, and she made this before the House inquiry panel on impeachment as well, was that of the 69 rule suspensions, I believe since 1977, so dating back over 30 years, that the JCAR panel has done, and that is rules where they've had to say you cannot do this. Half of those, roughly half of those, have been during the Blagojevich administration. So pointing out that in some respects, this administration, maybe more than any other previously, has not worked well, or has not worked through the process as is required in state government. So again, she will answer specific questions as we move forward, and then we'll also likely hear from the Auditor General sometime later today as well.
My last question here is that the last people, once they've formulated their questions, yesterday it was Special Agent Kane, today it was Representative Chapin Rose. A lot of questions are going out, but a lot of the answers are, well, that's beyond the scope of what they were called to do. Now, is Vicki Thomas going to be a little more flexible? Are we going to hear more direct answers?
I think we will, if they, of course, are tied in with what her job is and what she does know. Certainly, what we heard from Chapin Rose, the state representative, he was called to talk about a specific portion of that House impeachment panel's report on that recommended impeachment of the governor. And some of the questions got way out of the scope of the area he was being called for. And of course, yesterday we had an FBI agent, and we knew going in there that they were not going to allow him to comment on many aspects of the ongoing criminal investigation into the governor, and that is that of course played out in the trial as well, with him constantly saying I cannot answer that, or I just can't get into this situation and discuss it any further. So I think those two things might have been a little bit more. The word I'm looking for, I guess, is a little bit more special than what we probably will hear from Vicki Thomas. If these questions stick with the JCAR discussion, then we will likely hear her answer. I don't think we will hear her too often use that same phrase that she's unable to reply.
And in ways of recapping, this is live coverage of the impeachment trial of Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich in the state Senate. And senators just finished hearing testimony from Vicki Thomas, who is involved with the state's rulemaking authority. Senators have now taken a break. They will meet back at 1 o'clock. They'll also take a lunch break during that time. They are also formulating questions for Ms. Thomas. After that break, it will resume the trial will resume coming up here at 1 o'clock. You're listening to live coverage of the impeachment trial of Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich in the state Senate, coming to you from Springfield on IPR, Illinois Public Radio.
WIS would like to thank IEA, the Illinois Education Association, for helping to offset the cost of this special programming. Information about the IEA Invest in Excellence campaign is online at ieanea.org. Thank you.
You're listening to WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Media at Illinois. Good morning. My name is David Inge. Apparently now we are at a break in our live coverage of the impeachment trial in the Illinois State Senate of Governor Rod Blagojevich. As you heard this morning, the senators were hearing testimony from Vicki Thomas, executive director of the Joint Commission on Administrative Rules. The prosecutor in the case, the special prosecutor, David Ellis, asked some questions, and then he said he had concluded with that and turned things over to the members. And as was just explained here in the coverage from IPR a moment ago, the way they're working this is the special prosecutor asks his questions, and then there's an opportunity for the members of the Senate to ask questions. And what they have done is asked for a recess so they can go in private and talk about what they would like to ask, the questions they would like to have asked of the guests. They're also, I think, going to take a lunch break. So it's our understanding that the coverage will resume this afternoon at 1, right here on AM 580. So I expect that long about our usual time, a little bit before noon, we'll get our update on the commodities, and then we will have the opportunity to have what is the usual noon show. I expect that Celeste will be along to do the usual kind of report of news and information that you can expect, that you usually expect here on AM 580, then we will bring you an update on news. We'll have some features, and we'll have the weather, and then we will give you an opportunity to go back and resume the coverage from Springfield. Just to bring you up to date a little bit on what, for I'm sure for a lot of people, is indeed the big story, or at least something that they're struggling with this morning, and that is the weather. Here in the state of Illinois, we have had some really serious winter weather to deal with this morning. For example, here there are thousands of people don't have electricity, and schools are closed across the southern part of Illinois after the second wave of a big winter storm buried much of the region under more than half a foot of snow and ice. For the second day, classes have been canceled at hundreds of schools in the area, including Southern Illinois University's campuses in Carbondale and Edwardsville. That storm followed a front that glazed the region with ice and slush. There are some reports of as much as 9 inches of snow in some areas. About 6,000 members of the Southern Illinois Electric Cooperative in Dongola are without power, as well as about 8,600 Ameren customers. Then over there in the state of Indiana, things are also similarly affected. Indiana University closed its 39,000-student Bloomington campus today because of hazardous travel conditions. I think what we're going to do here is take a moment to talk with our weather forecaster, Mike Sola. He is in the weather office, and he has been following this throughout the day. What can you tell us, Mike, about what's now going on across the region, and particularly have things calmed down some, or are things particularly still difficult in the southern parts of the two states?
Well, David, as far as precipitation, it is done in Illinois, and we have almost a cloud-free sky across the entire state. But again, some of the road conditions will not improve very quickly. We have colder air pushing in. Our temperature back down to 19 degrees, and across Indiana, they still have clouds intact and a little bit of snow still falling in far east central Indiana. But again, as far as precipitation goes, we're pretty much done with it for now. We do have another band of light snow heading in our direction for tomorrow. We don't look for much in the way of measurable snow, probably less than a half inch, and even in the heaviest affected areas tomorrow. So what we have now is probably going to be the worst of it. We do look for some improvement in road conditions, and I have been keeping an eye on that across the area, courtesy of the Illinois Department of Transportation. And let's see if I can get quickly to that updated road conditions. Again, clear skies across the area, so that will help. I just went out and checked our snowboard, and even after the 7 o'clock measurement that we sent in, which on Friends Plaza amounted to 4.1 inches of snow, we had areas that may have picked up another half inch of the flurry activity. And IDOT updated as of 11:04 this morning the road conditions. So Interstate 57 has improved, still patchy all the way from Chicago to, looks like, around Coles County, and then between Coles County and the northern tip of Effingham County, actually Douglas County, and Coles County, Cumberland County, you're still going to find some snow and ice-covered roads. So travel may still be problematic in that area. Also, around the Springfield area, Interstate 55 looks to still be snow-covered in secondary roads. Again, snow and ice-covered all across the southern two-thirds of the state. Main interstates, highways across the northern third of the state are in decent shape. Secondary roads still patchy, but again, what we're going to have to contend with now is the cool conditions, winds that will be around 8 to 16 miles per hour is what we have forecast. So we may see a few locations with 20 mile per hour winds, and the nature of the snow that came in, relatively fluffy, so there may be some areas that see some drifting, and with a west wind, that would mean north-south roads are probably going to be impacted the most.
Okay. Well, thanks for the update, Mike. We appreciate it. And then, of course, you'll be back in, I guess about an hour as part of the regular noon hour of the Afternoon Magazine to give us an update at that point.
Yeah, and one other thing that I would like to mention is that there are still a couple locations that have the winter storm warnings in effect, just south, extreme southeastern Illinois, down in the southeastern corner of the state in southwestern Indiana. A little pocket in east central Indiana still has the winter storm warning in effect and a winter weather advisory for portions of north central Indiana, but they may either cancel them or they are going to expire soon. Again, with the precipitation ending, conditions should start to improve pretty drastically here soon.
All right, good. Well, thanks very much, Mike.
You're welcome.
We appreciate it. And also, maybe again, we'll mention for the benefit of people who live in Champaign-Urbana, particularly people who live in Champaign, the city of Champaign, they are activating the city's snow routes. And that goes into effect as of 11 o'clock. So actually, it already is in effect. And the snow routes that you should know if you're along one of them, they're marked by permanent signs. And if you're parked, if you have your car, your vehicle on the snow route after the activation, they are subject to towing at your expense. And parking remains prohibited on these streets until the Public Works Director cancels the activation. So the snow routes for the city of Champaign, they are in effect now. And that if you're parked there, you got to get your car off there by 7 o'clock tonight. So just do keep that in mind. Also, for pedestrians or for people who have businesses in Champaign, either in the downtown or the campus town areas, as of 10 o'clock this morning, the Public Works Director for the city declared that sidewalk snow and ice removal requirements were in effect. So that means that sidewalks have to be cleared 48 hours after this goes into effect. And again, if they're not cleared, the city will do it for you at the owner's expense. So again, you want to take that into consideration. And that went into effect at 10 o'clock this morning. We will have the usual noon hour of the Afternoon Magazine. Celeste Quinn is the host and will, of course, have an update on state and regional news for you at 12:30 thereabouts. And then following that, we will have, again, an update on the weather. And Mike Sola will be back to tell you about what's going on. Well, just again, to bring you an update, we have been bringing you live coverage from Springfield of the trial in the Illinois State Senate, the impeachment trial of Governor Blagojevich. The president of the State Senate today challenged the governor to show up for the trial instead of spending his time on national news shows, and that's what he's been doing here for the past couple of days. He appeared on The View. He appeared on Larry King. President John Cullerton says that it's a mistake for the governor to talk to people like Larry King instead of testifying at the trial. Governor Blagojevich spent Monday and Tuesday making the talk show circuit in New York. He repeatedly complained that the Senate impeachment trial is unfair and that the shocking quotes released when he was arrested in December are being taken out of context. Cullerton said today that the governor can provide that context if he would testify at the trial. He said that there is no one better than Governor Blagojevich to explain what was going through his head while the FBI agents were recording his telephone calls. This morning, as you heard, we finished up with some testimony from Chapin Rose, Senator Chapin Rose. He took questions from other members, his fellow members. He was on the stand for a bit, and then they shifted to Vicki Thomas, who was executive director of the Joint Commission on Administrative Rules. She responded to some questions from the special prosecutor, David Ellis, and then they requested an adjournment so that the members could privately, the Republicans and the Democrats could privately gather, talk about the questions that they would like relayed to Vicki Thomas, and that will be happening later this afternoon. And I think they decided to combine their caucus with a lunch break. So last information we have is that the proceedings will resume at 1, and then, of course, at that time, we will resume our coverage. Well, we're going to take a little bit of time here this morning to talk with Andrew Leopold. He is professor of law here at the University of Illinois. He's been good enough to pick up the telephone and talk a little bit about the proceedings with us. And we also can take questions from listeners as well. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. We want to just take a moment just before we do this to do a couple of underwriting announcements. We want to get those in, and then we'll talk in just a second with Professor Leopold.
Support for WILL comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, 6th and University in Champaign. Now serving dine-in, lunch, and dinner daily from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m., featuring a Middle Eastern menu along with hot soup, Turkish coffee, and herbal teas. World Harvest invites you to join them in supporting public radio. Support for Focus 580 comes from Bodywork Associates, bringing precision neuromuscular massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Now with 4 area locations, including inside the new Activities and Recreation Center north of Memorial Stadium on the U of I campus. More information is at bodyworkassociates.com.
And we have, as I said, joining us this morning by telephone, Andrew Leopold. He's professor of law here at the University of Illinois. Professor Leopold, thanks very much for giving us some of your time. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
I don't know if you have any general sort of reaction to how the proceedings have gone so far.
It's a curious thing, right? There's no proceeding like it that I can remember where the witnesses don't really have first-hand knowledge, other than FBI agent Kane, who obviously had listened to the wiretaps, but this is mostly people summarizing sort of general knowledge, what they've been told, general understandings, all of which is perfectly fair game in an impeachment proceeding, though it would not be in most court proceedings. So it's been curious so far.
Well, that I suppose that is the central thing that people are trying to come to grips with. This, there is a judge, there is a prosecutor, there are people who are being called as witnesses. They're being asked questions, and so in those superficial respects, it's like a criminal trial, and yet it's really not a criminal trial. The same sort of rules don't apply.
Well, not only do the rules of evidence not apply explicitly by the Senate rules, but also, of course, the lack of adverse party, the lack of the governor or his legal team to challenge, probe, question the information that's being put forward makes this quite an unusual situation and not a very satisfying one in some regards. I think most of us would like to see a little bit more detail, a little bit more testing and probing, but that was the call the governor made, and the Senate can only do what it can do.
Yeah, the governor has repeatedly said that he is boycotting the proceedings because he feels that they are unfair, that he's not been accorded due process, that he's not being allowed to call witnesses, that he's not being allowed to defend himself, and I think, in fact, that's really not quite true. Although, as you say, he has elected not to be involved, and I guess I wonder, to the extent that you would feel like you could comment, what do you think about that as a legal strategy, saying essentially this is unfair, my rights are not being respected, and there's no so for that reason, there's really no point in me to even participate.
Well, as long as he doesn't mind the Senate making the decision based only on the evidence put forward by the prosecutor, I guess that's up to him. It's It's obviously not very strategically wise, and the fact that the governor either misunderstands or misstates what this proceeding is about and what the rules would have allowed him to do and not to do, this is really on the governor's shoulders. I think all of us would like it to be different, but I wouldn't be very optimistic if I was him, and from the news accounts and the many interviews he's done, it doesn't sound like he expects the outcome to be anything other than removal.
No, I think I did have the opportunity to see the interview he did the other night with Larry King, and he said as much, that he fully expected that he would be removed from office.
Yeah, which is just another curious piece in an ongoing curious puzzle, because why then do all these interviews? I know it's been a columnist in the Chicago Tribune speculated that he's setting up the hope, anyway, that he'll be acquitted at the criminal trial and then will be able to resume a life in public service afterwards by saying, well, look, that whole impeachment thing, that was just a farce. I didn't even bother to show up and see. I was acquitted in the criminal trial. Well, that remains to be seen whether he'll be acquitted, but in terms of acting the role of the governor and showing respect for the legislative branch's very grave and well-founded concerns, I don't want to prejudge the outcome, but concerns about his fitness for office, not showing up is not the smartest strategy I can think of.
We have some callers here, and I'm interested in what they think.
Sure.
Maybe just if I could ask you one further quick question, mm-hmm. and I'm not sure, you know, to what extent this is something that you can respond to, but as you say, we don't know what will happen. It appears likely the governor will be removed from office. As I said, he seems to say, it seems to indicate that he thinks he will be. Is there any basis for him to mount a legal challenge to what is essentially a political action, and that is his impeachment and removal from office?
This is so rare that I'll never say never, but no, he doesn't really have, as far as I know, much of a basis to challenge, to go to court and ask the court to, what, reinstate him as governor? I don't think so.
All right. We have some callers here, and we have maybe about 5-6 minutes. We'll take them in the order they came in, and we'll start with, I believe, someone in Champaign County and on our line one. Hello.
Yeah, I haven't listened to most of it. I'll confess that from the beginning, and I'm very conflicted about it in some ways, but I think the sooner we have the lieutenant governor sworn in, the better. But I was taken by section I did hear happened to be with Chapin Rose. I didn't hear him this morning. I heard him yesterday afternoon. And it seemed to be so tendentious. I mean, this idea of speaking for Rezko, repeating the name of Atta over and over as if, you know, the Syrian connection was the most important facet of the trial was just seemed to be beyond belief. I mean, Rezko dealt with Cellini, the head of the Sangamon County Republican Party, and they're both indicted, co-indicted in a case of shaking down a movie producer in connection with this whole pay-to-play thing. And I just it seemed to me that had I just wanted to note it. Actually, I guess I don't know how you'll react, but it as I say, I just happened to listen to that section of it, and it struck me as it's probably terribly misrepresentative of the proceedings. I hope. Thank you.
All right. Well, I don't know. You have any thought about that?
Well, the only thought is it really shows the wisdom of the way we do criminal trials, right? We like to hear from the actual witnesses, not somebody saying something who said someone to something else. And again, this is not a criticism of the Senate or of anyone involved in the proceedings. They can only do what they can do when they're hampered by the inability to get information from the U.S. Attorney's Office, who, of course, has his own issues with the criminal case. But it really is odd to hear third and fourth hand accounts on something this important.
Mm-hmm. It seems, and I think if the caller was referring to with the proceedings this morning, when questions were being read There were questions posed by the members being read to Chapin Rose, who was on the stand.
Right.
It was a little, it was almost a little difficult to keep up with because the questions were all over the board. But it seemed that many of them were there were a lot of questions that were focused on the effect that the governor's actions had on the state.
Sure.
On its financial condition, on whether the governor's loss of his security clearance that happened when he was arrested affects his ability to deal with the federal government in case there's a crisis, and it seemed that what the legislatures legislators are trying to, in a sense, lay a foundation for the assertion that says, because of everything that's happened, because of the allegations that have been made, that it is impossible for the state, for the machinery of state government to function, and that that our only alternative would be to remove the governor and then move on so that we can actually get back to the business of trying to govern the state.
Yeah, it's not, and that's why it's so important that this is a political proceeding. You can conclude what you wish or not about the governor's behavior and whether or not it violates a criminal law or is merely in bad taste. But the point is, we need a governor, and it's the legislature's, the Senate now, task to decide whether this, the best interests of the state are served by having Governor Blagojevich continue in office. So in some sense, you don't even need to get down to the fine details about what the governor said to whom, although that's obviously part of the allegation as well.
Another caller here, someone in Morris on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Yeah, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? I'm in the kind of the boat of saying, well, to me, all I've been hearing is a lot of talk about him being guilty, and he may have said a lot of stuff on the TV and the radios, but he didn't really commit doing anything. And I think he personally, I think that Patrick Fitzgerald jumped the gun. I think he should have waited until he actually did it to sell the seat to get more on it, because I haven't heard anybody come out and say anything one way or the other that he actually broke any rules. And, I mean, I've heard conflicting reports, and I'm not on his side. By no means. I think the guy's a goofball. But, I mean, well, you know, everybody's saying that. I actually got back from a visit during the Christmas holidays from California, and first thing anybody ever talked about was, boy, your governor in the state, you know, is really screwed up. I mean, it was, I actually had to go to a funeral. That's what they were asking. The first thing, it wasn't, hi, how are you, and all this kind of stuff. Oh, that governor is an idiot. But I want to see what your point of view is. Does he really have a legal stance to defend himself? And is everything out? I mean, are they going to put more charges that are a fact instead of hearsay? And I'll get off. Thanks.
Yeah, that's a nice question. The important thing to remember is once we shift to the criminal case, first of all, there's been no indictment in the criminal case, and so we don't even know the formal charges that the governor will face, assuming that he is indicted. But the question of whether he's done anything yet before he actually sold the seat, that's conspiracy, right? Almost certainly one of the important charges against the governor, should he be indicted in the criminal case, will be a conspiracy, an agreement to commit a crime. And under federal law, to commit acts that defraud the people of Illinois of money or honest services is a crime. And if you agree to do that, it's conspiracy to commit a crime, whether you do it or not. So I'm not saying that, I'm not trying to prejudge that the governor has engaged in a conspiracy, but the mere fact that he hasn't done the actual bad act yet, the selling of the seat, the withholding of the money, won't necessarily help him in the criminal case, depending on the charges.
Well, and I think that so much attention has been focused on the allegation of selling the Senate seat that it has, I think, taken away from the fact that there are a number of other allegations that come under this general heading, what we have now come to know as pay to play.
Right.
That is, allegations that there was this this offer of a state contract or a state job in exchange for money.
Right. The I will sign this bill that will provide you with money if you give money to my campaign is at least strongly suggested in the FBI affidavit
that came from the wiretaps.
You know, that certainly was what was the issue yesterday with the few excerpts that they played, that this allegation that there was a bill that would benefit the horse racing industry.
Right.
And
right.
The allegation is that the governor said, yeah, okay, you want me to sign this? Well, it's going to cost you. And that would just be one of many examples, apparently, that the federal investigators have of that kind of activity.
But the caller does make a good point that when you move before the crime, the underlying crime is committed, and you're relying on conspiracy, it's harder in some respects because, of course, even the excerpts we heard from the wiretaps yesterday, which presumably were the clearest examples the prosecutors could present, they don't talk directly the way you just did about, if you give me money, I will sign your bill. It's indirection, it's nods, it's winks. And so it's not going to be a lay down hand for the prosecutor when and if an indictment is returned.
And so then it will be up to a jury to make a decision about
to a jury.
What would happen. Well, there we'll have to leave it. Professor Leopold, thanks very much for giving us some of your time. Our guest is Andy Leopold. He's professor of law here at the University of Illinois. Well, that's where we're going to finish up for right now. Again, we are this week bringing you live coverage from Springfield of the impeachment trial in the Illinois Senate of Governor Rod Blagojevich, and right now they are scheduled to resume, and our coverage will resume at 1 o'clock this afternoon. But for right now, we'll turn things over to Celeste Quinn. She is the host of the Afternoon Magazine, and I think we'll probably have our usual noon hour of news, weather, sports, and other things.
That's the plan. So what we'll do is we'll begin this morning, late this morning, 2 minutes before noon, with a look at the commodity markets. And let's go and take a look at how things are faring. Lots of green on the screen today. March wheat in Kansas City is trading at 623 and three quarters, up 8 3/4. May, 634 and three quarters, up 8 1/4. In Chicago, March wheat, 596, up 11 1/4. May, 609 and a half, up 12. March corn, 382 and a half, up 5. May, 393 and a quarter, up 4 3/4. July, 403 and three quarters, up 4 1/2. September, 416, up 6 1/2. March beans, 990, up 14. May, 997 and three quarters, up 14. July, 1005, up 13 1/4. August, 997 and three quarters, up 12 1/4. September, 967, up 6. March meal, 313 even, up 440. March oil, 3298, up 21. At the Merck in Chicago, live cattle for February, that contract is trading at 81.30, up 2 1/2. April, 84.55, up 15. January, feeder cattle, 94.20, up 10. March, 90.20, down 7 1/2. February, lean hogs, 56.10, that contract up 35. Outside markets, March crude in New York, 41.65, up 7. The U.S. dollar, 83.96, down 44. The CRB index, 220.03, up 127. On Wall Street, the Dow is up 124 points at 82.99. The NASDAQ is up 46 at 1551. The S&P 500, 21 higher at 867. This is WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana. It is coming up on noon Central Time, 18 degrees in Urbana. A winter weather advisory remains in effect for portions of north central through northeast Indiana, and a winter storm warning remains in effect for portions of east central Indiana. Mike Solis forecast.